Welcome to Justice Visions, the podcast about everything new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Welcome to the new season of the Justice Visions podcast. My name is Tine de Strooper and I'm a professor of transitional justice at Ghent University.
Hello, I'm Brigitte Hermans. I'm a researcher at Justice Visions focusing on Syria.
And we wrapped up last season with a mini-series that Brigitte did on transitional justice in Syria. And from the feedback that we got, our listeners seem to really like the format of mini-series. So we'll do that again this season, where we'll explore a specific case or a specific topic in more depth. And this time, this will be the issue of transitional justice and historical accountability. And we'll be discussing that topic together with Sira Payaspero, also one of the Justice Visions researchers, and a studio guest. So they will be talking about cases where transitional justice rhetoric was mobilized as part of a broader decolonization struggle or a struggle for historical accountability.
Right. And we also have a lot of exciting things that we're planning for this season. And one is a crossover with a major podcast that we really enjoy, which is Traveling Concepts on Air. And we'll talk about that soon.
Yes, but for today, we have two special studio guests who are featured in a special issue of the Journal of Human Rights Practice on reparations beyond the state.
Our first guest is Luke Moffat from Queen's University at Belfast, who was one of the guest editors of this special issue, together with Cheryl Lauter and Kieran McEvoy, who is running a project on this topic. Welcome, Luke.
Hi.
And so our second guest is Catherine Fortin, who published a seminal book on the human rights obligations of armed groups. And she is also into podcasting herself. Catherine, great to have you here.
Thank you.
So look, we did this episode because of a special issue coming out on the topic of reparations beyond the state, and specifically, of course, on the responsibilities of armed groups. Why did we need more research on this topic?
I think that there's two main reasons for why we needed more research on this area. I think the first is it's the nature of violence and power has increasingly shifted away from the state or beyond the state in the past few decades. You know, we now see armed groups, corporations, and even international organizations are increasingly carrying out state-like functions, but are also involved in violations against civilians and other protected categories. A recent report by the ICRC, you know, has highlighted between 60 to 80 million people currently live under state-like governance of armed groups. So there's definitely a stronger call to focus on this issue. And I think the second issue is that reparations really struggle to be implemented by states due to lack of political will or other priorities that take greater focus. And so I think if we encourage other actors to remedy the harm they've caused, it's a public relations exercise, it's political. And so it may encourage the state as well to think about their own responsibility.
I mean, you're obviously showing how important this phenomenon is, empirically speaking. Looking at our podcast, we always talk about kind of the future and innovations in the domain of transitional justice. So what is this topic telling us about the direction in which transitional justice as a field is evolving?
For me, transitional justice is about having difficult conversations with those who are often marginalized, you know, whether they're victims or perpetrators, as a way to sort of find ways to deal with the past. Reparations are, I think, a sort of a key mechanism for doing that. You know, Louis Jeunet, when he was drafting the first impunity principles for the United Nations, said that no transitional justice solution is sustainable unless it comes from within the country. And I think we're going more in depth to that sort of research carried out about 15 years ago about bottom-up approaches, that the need to give local ownership and respect local agency in driving, dealing with the past. And I think armed groups, as actors who carry out violence and responsible for violations, is tapping into this more micro-level notion of ownership of dealing with the past. This goes beyond the state. And for victims, you know, they will, who are affected by violence by armed groups, will want to see certain reparations that only armed groups can do. I think a good example of this was fieldwork we'd done in Colombia a few years ago, where we met a group of mothers whose sons had been disappeared. And part of, you know, having that difficult conversation and getting some sort of remedy that was adequate for them was to go to the paramilitaries who disappeared their children. and engage in dialogue. It was very dangerous to them. It's high security prisons. But engaging them in human terms and treating them like almost like their own children, showing them love and care to try and encourage and to see what harm that they caused to these victims. And, you know, dozens of these women had actually secured the remains of their children. So I think the difficulty with transitional justice is we often focus on the state and we get a lot of resistance in trying to move forward on transitional justice issues. But I think reparations are a key mechanism to get not just redress for victims, but for those who are responsible for violations to take ownership of the harm that they've caused, to move away from denial, get out of their ideological trenches that justify such violence, and to move forward. This topic is gaining more interest as we see there's over 30 conflicts ongoing in the world. Most involved armed groups, but there's hundreds that exist. And we also see that the UN Special Rapporteur has recently brought out a report, which was conducted with research from, you know, Kieran McAvoy and Daniela Vargas Suarez in Queens, that really points to that this is like an important emerging area that we need to be engaging with.
Thank you. I wanted to broach the issue of non-state actors with you, Catherine, because in your article, of course, you zoom in on non-state actors and particularly on the Al-Hassan case before the International Criminal Court. And Al-Hassan is an alleged member of Ansar al-Din and chief of Islamic police, who is alleged to be involved in the work of the Islamic court in Timbuktu. So you are making this very innovative and maybe somehow controversial argument about how we should be rethinking the command and control responsibilities of those armed groups to prevent abuses under international humanitarian law, which basically approaches these groups as installing or featuring something like a domestic legal realm. Could you say a little bit more about how you're constructing that argument?
I guess I indeed sort of use the Al-Hassan case in my article as a returning point of analysis, arguing that this is a case that's currently before the International Criminal Court that's really put rebel governance initiatives under the spotlight and is forcing the International Criminal Court to look at some really difficult issues relating to armed group law and armed group courts. But my broader argument is that Al-Hassan case is by no means unique. And that comes back to what Luke indicated before about, you know, this research about 60 to 80 million people who are living under the control of non-state armed actors to the exclusion of the de jure government. So in these instances, there is quite plentiful research right now that kind of studies what armed groups do when they control territory in this manner to the exclusion of the de jure government. And I utilize this report, this information in my article to piece together, provide facts and figures on the use of law by armed groups. So for example, I cite studies showing that between 25 and 35% of armed groups do establish legislative bodies, courts, laws, police stations, schools, health clinics. Between 11.5% of armed groups have employed judicial processes. So the Al-Hassan case isn't unusual. And Mr. Al-Hassan, as I said at the beginning of the article, is probably just one of hundreds of thousands of very similar individuals who are taking on public functions in these areas, whether they be as police officers, as judges, as all kinds of other semi-government functions. And the fact that these individuals are doing this is really forcing then the practice to figure out how to respond. So when I wrote the article, I was thinking in particular about special rapporteurs from the UN, about people working at commissions of inquiry set up by the Human Rights Council, the legal counsel I just mentioned in front of the International Criminal Court, who are increasingly having to struggle with questions like, is armed group law law? Are armed group courts courts? And this is kind of a preliminary question that they need to grapple with, because the answer is going to determine how they engage with these kinds of law. Should the international community be asking armed groups to investigate if a particular violation has taken place? Should the international community be asking armed groups to prosecute if a particular crime has taken place? And what happens if an armed group does prosecute, like in the Al Hassan case, and then the court doesn't adhere to fair trial norms? What's the legal significance of that? So these are really difficult legal questions. And in fact, many authors have written on some of them before, but I try and take kind of higher altitude perspective in my article to look at the debate and figure out what's going on and the different kind of forces that are pushing and pulling within it. And of course, they're also not only questions of law, but they're questions of policy. And so these are the questions that I try to address in my article.
So, because in what you just said, you're focusing on what these actors are actually doing, but also on what the international community can then do in response. Maybe going back to what Luke was saying about what this means for people on the ground, could you elaborate a bit on that, what the advantage of this approach that you're proposing or describing is for actual civilians or victims living in these territories controlled by armed groups?
So I think that the practice in this area, and by practice, I mean the instances where you have international bodies or monitoring mechanisms addressing the acts of armed groups, has always been driven by the reality of what's happening on the ground, perhaps even more than the law. You know, in that regard, it's this strange dynamic where you have a set of facts on the ground that somehow have demanded the intervention of monitoring mechanisms in instances where the law has remained quite controversial and contested, as Brigitte said. I note that there is quite some practice of armed groups being addressed by UN special rapporteurs, by these UN working groups, by the commissions of inquiry and UN field offices, asking armed groups to investigate certain instances and sometimes to prosecute certain instances. And in my view, these instances are always explained by the facts on the ground and the perceived need to intervene on behalf then of the civilian communities and victims in that area, and the fact that there just isn't another recourse for intervention because the de jure government in these areas is absent. You know, my article is very much also focusing on kind of the benefits of indeed for people of utilizing human rights law. And I argue in relation to procedural right to remedy that this is a very victim orientated framework that is well capable of addressing everyday grievances, perhaps better capable of able to address those kind of everyday governance type grievances than international humanitarian law, and so then able to deliver access to a remedy for victims. I also kind of note that doing so prevents these territories becoming a kind of information black hole or a human rights vacuum. I guess at a very basic level, I see the utilization or the engagement with armed groups, legal institutional frameworks in this manner, as to be a kind of legal counterweight to their existing practices. So to explain that, it's very often the case that armed groups are kind of using their police forces, their courts, their structures as means to affect enforced disappearances, killings, torture, unfair trial. In addressing armed groups and arguing that they should be securing accountability for their members, you're in effect forcing them to use those institutions that they've already been using for, let's say, bad ends to secure accountability of their members and provide justice for victims.
Maybe just to explore this a little bit further, actually, you're also addressing the issue of exploring how international and domestic law can be deployed, let's say, more imaginatively, to also create frameworks to better deliver on reparations for victims, and maybe the needs also for victims more broadly. Could you maybe also address the issue of how obligations on armed groups also interact with obligations of the state?
Whenever you think about armed groups, it's always really important to be very specific about the armed group. You know, you can't tend to make statements about armed groups in a general sense. There are lots of different factors that need to be taken into account, not least the armed group's capacity, but also timing is really crucial. I situated my articles deliberately at a moment in time where, like in the Al-Hassan case, the armed conflict was ongoing, the state was absent, and the armed group was operating in a kind of closed area of space and time. And in this instance, as I already indicated, it's almost impossible for the state to do anything. But at a later moment in time, I think the landscape becomes very different, because at that moment, the de jure government is present again. And at that moment, it makes much more sense to be also engaging with the state. So I think that you can never look at the armed group's obligations and even construct the armed group's obligations without looking at their capacity and looking at the capacity of the state. And so, you know, this is an argument that was made really quite convincingly in another article that was written recently by someone called Olivia Herman, who's looked at reparations and armed groups. And she argues that you should have this kind of cascading approach where you first approach or consider the armed group to be the primary actor to provide reparations. But in instances where the armed group is incapable of providing reparations, or you could even imagine a moment in time where the armed group doesn't exist anymore, then she would suggest that according to this cascading framework that she sets forward, that the state should be approached either as a sole actor or as a complementary actor in addition to the armed group.
Maybe back to you, Luke, and zooming out a bit from the specific argument, I was wondering, when I look at the special issue of the Journal of Human Rights Practice, what I see is that the contributors to that have different backgrounds. And I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a bit more about how you feel that that affects the proposals that they come up with in response to questions about improving accountability, about ensuring reparations for victims living in territories controlled by these armed groups.
I think we were lucky enough to get a good range of authors, both with practical experience and also expertise from different disciplines. That speaks well to the audience for the Journal of Human Rights Practice, that, you know, we need to deal with the law. But we also wanted those who worked with armed groups, such as, you know, our conversation piece with Fighters for Peace. And like, you know, Kieran, Cheryl and myself, you know, we live in a society where armed groups exist. In Northern Ireland, there's about 13,000 people who are apparently members of armed groups, even though we're 25 years on from our peace process. So that's about 1 in 100 adults, which is, it's a crazy amount. And where you look at other countries that are, you know, post-conflict or facing conflict, you get quite similar numbers. And this poses real challenges to, you know, how we engage groups on the law and the respect basic principles that we would call under human rights and humanitarian law, but also to try to sell it to them in terms of practical ways of trying to keep the local civilian community on side and avoid sort of moral rapprochement that they will lose them supporters. And so we've tried to approach it in different ways, dealing with the law, dealing with the practical aspects, but also thinking forward, you know, how could armed groups use this? And so hopefully it'll be insightful for, you know, civil society actors, human rights practitioners, and maybe even armed groups to pick up and read some of these pieces about how they can do better. We also, as part of our reparations project, recently brought out a handbook for how humanitarian organizations can engage armed groups. So it draws from the piece that Kieran, Cheryl and I wrote by changing the script, about, you know, very much looking at the active responsibility of armed groups as both, you know, armed actors, but also as potential community leaders and peace builders. So I think it's about engaging differently in this area. And maybe to go back, you know, the question to Catherine, and, you know, Catherine got a really good answer about the issue of obligations, that, you know, we need to deal with the state. There was always a concern in human rights law, and there still is, that by focusing too much on the obligations and how human rights can apply to non-state actors, we're going to take it away from, you know, focusing on efforts on the state. And at the end of the day, in places, you know, like Syria, Yemen, and obviously Ukraine and Russia, the state clearly is able to mobilize violence on a far larger scale at armed groups. And at the end of the day, it has still got its obligations under human rights law, where it's got people within its jurisdiction. So we're not trying to take away from that, but we're trying to broaden the conversation and how we can deal with armed groups and their violence.
You were talking about different ways of engaging, but is there an emerging consensus of what that means in practice?
I'm not sure. I think from like a legal perspective, it's really nascent, that we haven't properly dealt with looking beyond the state. In the 80s, early 90s, there was a critical legal studies literature, which was, you know, very much looked at the place of civil society and victims in sort of using social movements to challenge the state. Transitional justice has looked a lot at victims, their agency. But I suppose what we're pointing to with this special issue is this notion of, like, the state has left the building. And there's a really rich literature, you know, that Catherine's very familiar with in political science around rebelocracy, how people live under the rule of rebels, and marrying, you know, this literature with the law. You know, with the special issue, we're trying to do that. You know, we've got two strands, you know, looking both at the legal perspective, but also the more political science and the sociological phenomenon of law and how it's constructed without the state. And I think it comes down to how do people act and interact, both as victims, civil society, and armed groups, in situations which, in transitional justice, we're often looking in, you know, well, post-conflict, post-authoritarian governments. But in these situations, it's protracted conflict, it's re-emerging conflict, it's fragile societies where there is insecurity, there's a real danger for victims to come forward and speak out. How do we sort of better protect, or, you know, allow people to access some sort of remedy without causing further violence for them? And I think, you know, Kieran McAvoy, one of the authors in this special issue, has worked for decades on this issue in Northern Ireland, particularly around restorative justice and encouraging armed actors in the Republican community and some loyalists to stop using intercommunal violence. There's a lot of new emphasis on old ideas. And I think we need to be also critical of the place of the state, and both politicising transitional justice, but also we need to recognise that, you know, transitional justice doesn't happen without victims. So how do we best support them when the state has left the building?
Maybe I can just add a small point there relating to your question about beyond the state, because this is also an issue that I wanted to deal with quite head on, and it's this issue of legitimacy and the extent to which the legal human rights discourse seems to continue to very much struggle to think beyond the state. So, which is indeed, I think, one of the principal reasons why there is this very difficult to shift view that engaging with armed groups, I think particularly on human rights norms, somehow gives them a veneer of legitimacy and somehow undermines the state as the state. And so, you know, it's really easy, I think, to draw on the law and say this is nonsense, because we all know that different actors under international law can have different levels of legal obligations and rights. So if you say that a non-state actor has obligations, this doesn't in any way mean that they are a state. But I feel that that's too easy. And so in the article, I kind of try and unpick where this legitimacy discourse is coming from, particularly within the human rights field, and why it's there. And I, you know, I draw upon other people's scholarship by Kieran McAvoy about legalism from below. This is this idea that if you adopt a thin discourse of human rights, which recognises the state as the sole duty bearer, then to say that another entity has human rights law, then you do risk legitimising them, or you do introduce into the discourse this notion that the entity is somehow approaching statehood. But I argue in my article then that this highlights the real importance of exploring different ways of creating multiple thicker kind of interwoven discourses that recognize that different entities can have human rights obligations dependent on their capacities and the capacity of the state in a given situation. And one of my conclusions is exactly this, that more thought needs to be given to exploring human rights discourse beyond the state, such that you can put a brake on this legitimacy idea that is so easy to dismiss, but also so very real.
Thank you. And actually, Luke and Catherine, I think in these last two things that you said, you already answered the last question that we normally ask to all our interviewees, which is where you are looking for inspiration and what you think the kind of next paradigm shift is in the field. And I'm sensing that for the two of you, that's really in looking beyond the state, which I think is also really interesting, because in a way, it's like where the future of the field lies and where the field is going. And at the same time, it's also kind of going back to the disruptive origins of transitional justice, isn't it? Which was also not necessarily such a statist approach as it has become true processes of formalization and legalization. So that in a way I think is very interesting. So on that note, I am just going to thank you for a wonderful conversation. And for our listeners, you can reread the show notes of this episode via the Justice Visions website. That's justicevisions.org, where you will also find hyperlinks to all the books and articles and resources that were mentioned in this episode, several of which, including Catherine's article, are actually freely accessible online. For our next episode, we'll be back with, as I mentioned, a miniseries on historical accountability, for which I will be joined by co-host Sira Pai Aspero. And for now, I'm just going to thank Catherine and Luke so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.